Welcome back. This next lecture is going to be on punishments regarding the criminal law. And we're going to discuss a little bit about criminal law and what kind of penalties arise out of that, the theory of criminal punishments. Why do we do it? What is it involved in? If you remember, obviously, the criminal law is the body of law that defines offenses against the community at large, regulates how suspects are investigated, charged, and tried, and establishes punishments for convicted offenders. The criminal justice system does all of that, and it assesses the system by which the criminal law is administered. The criminal law is the branch of law that defines those crimes and establishes punishments. It's broken down into substantive law and criminal procedure. Substantive law is the actual crime that gets committed, the definition of that crime and the prescription of the punishment. And criminal procedure is the process and rules by which justice is administered. Now, in order to have criminal law, one of the indispensable elements of it is to punish people for misconduct, because by doing that, we deter crime and we prevent it from occurring, and we're able to bring justice to those who would conduct such misconduct. There's several different theories of why we have punishment to crimes. They include retribution, deterrence, restraint, rehabilitation, and restoration. Sometimes punishments of these types advance more than one of these goals at the same time. Other times they may promote goals while conflicting with the other ones. Let's run through each one of them. Retribution. Retribution holds that the punishment is imposed on the blameworthy person in order for society to attain justice and punish the conduct that the criminal commits. Its purpose is to make criminals, persons who commit criminal acts, to pay for their conduct. Supporters of this theory look upon punishment not just as a tool to deter future crime by using that as an example to others, don't do this or this will happen to you, but also as a device for ensuring that offenders pay for their past misconduct and that justice is delivered. That it's only fair you do this, whereas everybody else is behaving properly in society, you're not, so justice has to be brought to you by means of punishment. Deterrence is probably the most important reason for punishment. Those who support this theory believe that a punishment is imposed on the person, that the punishment will dissuade the offender and others from repeating that crime. There's two types of deterrence. There's specific deterrence and general deterrence. Specific deterrence says, if we put this person in jail, they won't commit the crime. Why? They're in jail. They can't. We ostracize them from society. We separate them and put them in jail because they've shown a propensity to commit criminal acts. They won't be committing it again, as long as they're in jail anyway. So this is specific deterrence. It means that that person isn't going to create the crime. Hopefully teach them a lesson, they won't commit it again, but at least while they're in jail, they're not going to commit it. So specific deterrence goes to the individual who committed the crime. General deterrence goes to society, where specific deterrence teaches that person a lesson, saying you're going to be held in jail, you're not going to be able to commit crimes while you're in jail, and at least not on general society. And as a result of that, you're going to be punished for this. Don't do this again. This is an example to you, person who's creating the crime, who's committing it. General deterrence offers an example of the person being punished to everybody else. Don't do that. Don't steal a car. You'll get many years in jail. That offers a deterrence to others by showing that if you do this criminal conduct, this punishment will be inflicted upon you. So specific deterrence goes to the individual person who committed the act. General deterrence goes to other people who might commit the act and say, look at what happened to him, don't do it. Restraint. Theory of restraint is that if a person is confined, it's similar to deterrence, and they cannot have the opportunity to commit further crimes while they're incarcerated or while they're killed. And that is specific deterrence. They'll say, if you restrain that person, you're not going to be able to commit crimes while they're restrained. Rehabilitation is the hoped for benefit of criminal punishment. And this is where people believe that with education and treatment, the example that is set, that a person may be able to reform themselves, that they will change their criminal tendencies, because they're given the education and given the message that don't do this again. This is not something that is a benefit to society. It's a reform vision. It's got a heavy religious concept to us, and that many religious leaders favor reform because they say that you want to change the hearts and minds of those who have committed the criminal acts, saying, look, you've really hurt someone by committing this act. This is not the way that good moral people behave, that we want to change those behaviors through education and example. We want to make you a better citizen by means of this. And indeed, this concept of rehabilitation and of reform runs throughout our punishment in our criminal justice system. Many people think that it should do more of that, and that would be a good thing if it could. But just recognize the term penitentiary comes out of this theory. Why? Because the criminal was designed to do penitence, meaning that they would turn around and assess what wrong they have done and feel bad about it. And then once they get released, wouldn't do again. They wouldn't take that kind of behavior anymore. And this issue of learning from your crime, learning the harm you've done to others, appreciating your act for being wrong. And again, there's a large moral religious concept of this, that you'll reform yourself and you won't do it anymore. Restoration says that a victim should compensate, should be compensated by the criminal. That if I steal the car, that car ought to be returned, and that the car ought to be able to be returned in the manner in which it was stolen from them in the first place. If we had theft of something or damage to something, that'll be created, and the victim ought to be put back into the level that they were before. That's not always possible, not only because of limited resources frequently of those who commit the crimes. They don't have the ability to provide restoration. In almost every criminal act, they're adjudicated that they have to pay the victim back. Well, frequently that never happens. Why? Because they don't have the resources to do it in the first place, and they may not have been going down that criminal path if they did have those resources. So is the economic instance of a criminal the reason for them committing the crime? No. Their misbehavior and misconduct is the reason. But obviously, people in poor circumstances tend to do more criminal behaviors than people in wealthy circumstances, at least under what we call violent crime, and that which the criminal code was really established. Restoration is a great term for punishment. It is a great theory of punishment. We want our victims to be made as whole as possible. But again, sometimes that's not possible. How is it possible to restore a murder victim? You really can't. You try and do some things for the family, but at the end of the day, damages doesn't replace that. And if a certain person was impacted by the death, guess what? There's not much you can do. Now, we have allowed for things like murder victims' relatives to testify on the sentencing of that. But at the end of the day, restoration isn't as complete depending on the violence of the crime. Now, all of these theories of punishment interact. Some of them can work together. Deterrence can work with restoration. Deterrence can work with retribution. But sometimes these conflict too, that the call for unpleasant experiences, you know, the punishment aspect for retribution sometimes has a negative effect. You know, when you send a young person into jail at a young age and they become incarcerated, sometimes they become more hardened criminals. They learn things that they didn't know on how to commit criminal acts and how to do it more viciously or more effectively. And those goals are not beneficial to deterrence. So, you know, sometimes these punishment goals work together, sometimes they conflict. And the law does seek to combine these theories where they can. I'll give you an example. Knowing that, you know, sentencing a very young person in with very experienced criminals, which serves retribution, may not serve the deterrence or other restoration factors or a factor of reform, programs such as Shock Camp have come into play, whereby those young people are separated out and provided with punishment of and of themselves together on a nature to say, hey, listen, you're young. Your life hasn't really progressed much. You got to learn from this experience. You have to make sure you don't repeat it. So the law tries to do this in many circumstances with criminal offender ranges where somebody has had a crime multiple times, they get a longer sentence than somebody who's just done it the first time. So they have an opportunity to learn from that and have the ability to get what we call parole, which is being able to be released after a portion of your sentence. Also to have an opportunity for education in that. So you have to try and use the law, in the criminal law, in order to make these goals of punishment, all of which are valuable, work together rather than apart. Now, because punishment is important to deter crime, and that's really what we want. We want these conduct not to occur in the first place. We try to make the punishment fit the crime, because it does no good just to have executions for everybody or put everybody in jail for the rest of their lives. That isn't a benefit to society. So we classify crimes to be able to let the punishment fit the crime. And crimes are classified in two ways under common law. Malum in se, that's a crime that is evil in and of itself. It's a bad act. Society can't permit that. And others are called mala prohibita. And it's illegal because the law says it is. And, certain acts are just evil. If you commit murder, that's an evil act. If you turn around and unlawfully discharge a weapon in the air because you were out hunting and the gun went off before you got to the hunting ground, you didn't intend to have that happen, and it was stupid, but it wasn't evil. It wasn't something that you had a bad intent on. So, you know, the law does differentiate between that. But one of the biggest differentiations is between felonies and murders. Or, I'm sorry, felonies and misdemeanors. Sorry. Felony at common law was a crime that was punishable by death. It was the most serious crime. A felony is the highest level crime that you can commit. And again, at common law, its penalty could be death. Misdemeanor, on the other hand, were considered less serious crimes, and their crimes were punishable at common law by imprisonment. Today, felonies and misdemeanors have a different meaning. Felonies are still the most serious crimes, as they were in common law, but not all felonies today are punishable by death. What constitutes a felony and what delineates between a felony and a misdemeanor is a felony is punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year. So if it's punishable for more than 1 year, it's constituted as a felony under New York state law. If it's a misdemeanable, it's a I am Mr. Malaprop today. If it's a misdemeanor, that crime is punishable by fine or imprisonment of less than 1 year. So if it's a year or more, it's a felony. If it's less than a year under New York state law, it's a misdemeanor. Misdemeanors are less serious crimes, but they're still criminal conduct. Felonies are the worst crimes. And often felonies have penalties far beyond just their incarceration, beyond their imprisonment. Felons can't vote. Felons have a record that will follow them forever because frequently they won't be hired as a result of that in their jobs. There's all kinds of issues that come with the commission of a felony. And each jurisdiction, by the way, so if I go to Massachusetts, the felonies in New York may not be the felonies in Massachusetts. Each jurisdiction determines the penalties for the offenses in its jurisdiction. A misdemeanor in one jurisdiction may be a felony in another, and vice versa. Now, in addition to whether or not a crime is a felony or a misdemeanor, they often will delineate offenses by what we call degrees or grades. These degrees or grades identify crimes within their category of crime based on seriousness. So murder in the first degree is the worst level of murder, and you have that as the most serious crime. Murder in the second degree is still a very serious felony, but it's less serious, and it carries with it less of a punishment. Similarly, many felonies or even misdemeanors have what we call classes. Class A, Class B, Class C, Class D, Class E, all the way down the line. And a Class A crime, a Class A felony, for example, is much more serious than a Class B felony. And a Class B felony is much more serious than a Class C felony. And those classes determine the length of imprisonment for committing that crime. And each one of these has different elements within that based on your intent, based on your age, based on what actions you take and the damage that you cause. So not only do you have degrees, but you also have letter grades that determine the seriousness of the crime. That's within the classification between felony and misdemeanor you have those grades and those degrees within that provision. Lastly, let's just talk for a second about violations. Violations are not crimes. Violations are petty offenses called infractions or violations, which are punishable by generally fine conduct. Sometimes they could be punishable by imprisonment, but it's for a very short sentence. To give you an example, violations are things like speeding on the highway, tipping over a trash can at Halloween. They're not criminal conduct, but they're something that the society at large does not prescribe as a good idea, and you can get punished for doing it if you're convicted. Now, the criminal procedure law governs violations as well as felonies and misdemeanors. So as a result of that, you still have to be convicted of these things. The procedures are very similar, whether or not you are charged with a felony or a misdemeanor or a violation as to your procedures of doing it. And as a result of that, you have to follow the criminal procedure law. Now, they're not identical in procedure. To give you an example, a judge is the one who will convict you of a speeding ticket. You're not entitled to a jury trial for a speeding ticket, okay? But for any criminal offense, you are entitled to a jury trial. And it doesn't matter whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, you're entitled to a jury. You're not for certain violations you are, but for most violations you're not. And the judge will determine that. They become what they call the trier of fact. With respect to a crime, the jury is always the trier of fact. That concludes our issues on punishment. Next time, we're going to talk about the common law felonies. They're the worst felonies you can commit. And again, common law felony, punishable by death at common law. See you shortly.